When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Blogging Theology. Today, I'm delighted to talk to Professor John Hoover. You are most welcome, sir.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Great to have you on. For those who don't know, John Hoover is Professor of Islamic Studies at the University of Nottingham here in the UK. His expertise is obviously Islamic studies, especially Islamic intellectual history, medieval Islamic theology and philosophy, the thought of Ibn Taymiyyah and Ibn Qayyim, and Christian-Muslim theological interaction. And his current work examines how Ibn Taymiyyah formulates his unique views of God's attributes in dialogue with his theological, philosophical, and socio-political context. In today's podcast, Dr. Hoover will be discussing what he calls Ibn Taymiyyah's religious utilitarianism. Now, I must admit that before I read John's fascinating article, which is in a book about this topic titled Foundations of Ibn Taymiyyah's Religious Utilitarianism, I never expected to hear the English philosopher Jeremy Bentham and his utilitarianism mentioned in the same breath as Ibn Taymiyyah. So that raised an eyebrow or two when I first read that. But it's been explained very clearly what you mean by that. Now, Bentham, interestingly, has defined as the fundamental axiom of his philosophy the principle that, quote, it is the greatest happiness of the greatest number that is the measure of right and wrong, end quote. So, John, please introduce us to this fascinating topic.
Okay, thank you, Paul. And yes, we have the PowerPoint. So this is, as Paul mentioned, my presentation today is based largely on a book chapter that was published in 2019 called Foundations of Ibn Taymiyyah's Religious Utilitarianism. It's in a volume edited by Peter Adamson. And then what's really important about this article from my perspective is it is the theoretical backbone for my 2019 book on Ibn Taymiyyah, which is a general introduction to his life and thought. So the article is giving you the theoretical background to ideas that come out in simpler form in the book. I need to say, first of all, what I mean by utilitarianism. Mm. The term utilitarianism applied to Ibn Taymiyyah is not uncontroversial. Some people find it difficult to think about a modern term being applied to somebody who lived in the late 13th and early 14th century, or that such a term might apply to Islamic ethics, Islamic thought. So I want to be clear as to what I'm talking about. Yeah. Utilitarianism is a species of consequentialism, a broader category in ethics. Consequentialists talk about acting to produce the maximum good, or sometimes well-being, or benefit, or utility. And you can have that for yourself, for oneself, that's called ethical egoism, or for the maximum utility for everyone, and that's called utilitarianism. Now, to distinguish Jeremy Bentham, who Paul's kindly introduced already, from Ibn Taymiyyah and other thinkers in religious traditions we might think about, I've talked about secular utilitarianism and then religious utilitarianism. So the example of secular utilitarianism, Jeremy Bentham, as Paul said, greatest happiness of the greatest number is the criteria here for happiness, or the criteria for ethics of what is right and wrong. So it's about maximizing happiness, benefit, and pleasure in this world. And then I distinguish that by talking about religious utilitarianism, which is maximizing happiness, benefit, pleasure in this world and the hereafter, or in some sense, a religious component to this. This is not found only within Islamic tradition with Ibn Taymiyyah, but there are some Christian examples of this as well. So the idea here is that worshiping God and the afterlife have a role in thinking about what maximum happiness looks like. So with that explained, I'll move on to the argument. I'm going to outline the whole argument, and then I'm going to go into detail as we go on.
Okay.
So the first thing that is the foundation of the argument, which I'm actually not going to evidence for lack of time, is that for Ibn Taymiyyah, worship of God alone, really, we can talk about two aspects. One is it is the ultimate purpose of humanity. You may know the verse in the Quran that God created humans and the jinn for worship. And then the second aspect is worship of God alone is to the ultimate benefit of humans. Ibn Taymiyyah believes that. And, you know, what is most beneficial to us human beings? It's to worship God alone. That is our, of course, you can think about this as being beneficial at attaining the afterlife, the seeing God in the hereafter being the highest pleasure, and so forth. Yeah. Now, I have two basic parts of my argument today. The first part is going to be that Ibn Taymiyyah thinks in terms of religious utility and ethics and law. And then the second part, which is a little more complex, is that Ibn Taymiyyah also understands God's action in a utilitarian fashion. And for those who read the article, you'll know that I flipped them. I actually am doing the latter part of the article first, because it's somewhat easier to understand.
It is. I agree with your view there. That I found his religious utilitarianism in relation to ethics and law to be much easier to understand than the theology in the second one you listed there. So yeah, that was my response as well.
Yeah. So I've flipped them so we can perhaps follow things a little bit more easily. Okay. And then the conclusion is that for Ibn Taymiyyah, God's action and human action are both utilitarian in character, which is somewhat surprising. Not only is human action utilitarian, but God even has a kind of utilitarian ethic. Okay.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So let's begin then with the human side of it. So the idea that Ibn Taymiyyah's ethics are utilitarian is nothing new. I give just two examples to start us off. One from Michael Cook, his book in 2000, Commanding the Right and Forbidding the Wrong in Islamic Thought, a really thick volume, well worth reading even 24 years on. And he has about 3-4 pages on Ibn Taymiyyah. And he tells, among other things, a story of Ibn Taymiyyah going with his friends to visit the Mongol camp. So the Mongols, of course, had invaded Syria, and he and some friends went to see the Mongols, and they drank wine, of course. And some of his friends said, let's forbid them, you know, let's command the right here and tell them they really should not be drinking wine. And that's the wrong thing to do in God's eyes. Ibn Taymiyyah says, okay, let's think about this. No, let's not tell them they shouldn't be drinking wine, because if we look at the big picture, as I read there from the quote, the Muslims stood it to suffer more if the Mongols renounced their liquor. In other words, the fact that they were drinking wine and therefore impaired mentally meant they would not be as dangerous to the Muslims in the war. So
the Mongols at that stage, Muslims, actually, wasn't that the point? They described themselves.
The Mongols in that case confessed to be Muslims. But in Ibn Taymiyyah's view, they were not well-practicing Muslims. Yeah. And his views as he progressed got harsher toward them. But that's a different story.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So this little anecdote is for Cook illustrates Ibn Taymiyyah's thinking. And then a little bit more on Cook. Cook brings out that for Ibn Taymiyyah, that political authorities have a religious obligation, not just a secular obligation, but there's a religious obligation of political authorities to do what is best within their power, even if it entails some undesirable consequences, even if some undesirable consequences ensue. So political authorities, in deciding what to do, should weigh up the benefits and detriments of their actions and not just live completely apart from morality, but not be so scrupulous that they are tied up in knots and can't get anything done. So that's the second point here on the slide. It's not politics without morality. That means unscrupulous behavior by the rulers. And it's not morality without politics. In other words, complete scrupulosity. The ruler is very concerned to do everything exactly right, such that they miss the big picture and might not, say, defend the Muslim borders from an invader. So it's about balancing the two. So that's what Cook brings out of Ibn Taymiyyah's thinking. Mm. Another example, another scholar who's thought about this quite a bit is Yahya Misho. He talks about Ibn Taymiyyah's profound utilitarianism. Yeah. And Misho writes about this in a number of places, but I decided to highlight his book, Muslims Under Non-Muslim Rule, which was published in 2006. He talks in here, Ibn Taymiyyah's thinking about weighing up benefits, masalih in Arabic, and detriments, mafasid, of each act.
Yeah.
And he gives lots of examples in the book, but one I find really fascinating. It's the question, should we leave the company of disobedient and perverse people? Now, in Arabic, this is the term hijra. So we think of the Prophet's hijra from Mecca to Medina, but Ibn Taymiyyah is generalizing this. Whenever we find ourselves in the midst of a people who are bad company, should we undertake hijra away from them? So his view on this is, yes, normally we should leave, but we shouldn't leave if staying brings more benefit than detriment, or conversely, if leaving would cause greater detriment than benefit. Now, what might be the benefit of hanging out with bad company? Well, if we leave a Muslim bad company, we might lose access to the religious knowledge they have. So this is in the early centuries of Islam. We have the hadith, for example, of the Prophet Muhammad are spread throughout the community. They aren't all collected yet. So there's a risk if you decide that some other part of the Muslim community is not really good company for you, and you cut yourself off from them, you might be cutting yourself off from some religious knowledge that they happen to have, which would be detrimental, perhaps even more detrimental than hanging out with them.
Yeah.
So I found this example really helpful to understand Ibn Taymiyyah and his thinking and what the types of considerations one should take in making decisions about what to do. Now, Ibn Taymiyyah has another side of his thinking about ethics and law and so forth, which is in tension, we might think, with this utilitarian outlook. And that is, there is a law. There is a religious law. There's a Sharia. And it presumably would tell us what we should do and shouldn't do without having to think about benefits and detriments. Ibn Taymiyyah, though, he considers the law equivalent to justice. And as I'll show on the next slide, the law is equivalent to benefit. But let's look at this quotation first about the law and justice. So Ibn Taymiyyah writes in a treatise that's found in Majmu' al-Fatawa, which is the big modern collection of his writings in volume 35. The book and justice are inseparable. So that's Sharia and Adl are inseparable. The book explicates the law. The law is justice and justice is the law. Anyone who judges with justice judges with the law. The entire revealed law is justice. So he's equating the law and justice. You can talk about it either way. Mm-hmm. They're equivalent. And you can have justice apart from the law insofar as, he talks about this elsewhere, a non-Muslim ruler may be ruling according to justice. And if they are truly ruling according to justice, that's actually better than a bad Muslim ruler who is unjust. But justice and Sharia coincide. They're inseparable. And this parallels with Ibn Taymiyyah's well-known view that revelation and reason do not contradict. That's not the topic of the presentation, but he's really well known for the idea that reason and revelation say the same things. You can come at truth from both directions. Of course, revelation gives you things you can't know by reason, like exactly how to pray the five daily prayers and so forth. But on basics of religious truth about God, God's attributes and so forth, there is just simply no contradiction. If you are reasoning in a certain fashion, it doesn't agree with revelation, you're off. And if you're reading revelation in a certain fashion, it does not agree with reason, you're off in his thinking. Now we bring that to benefit. He says, likewise for Ibn Taymiyyah, law and human benefit are coextensive. The benefit is the law and the law is benefit. That's my wording. I've not seen him put it quite that way, but that's what it comes to. And there's no real benefit outside the law. What he does say in a treatise where he talks about this a lot, the principle overall is that the law never neglects a benefit. Indeed, God exalted as he has perfected the religion for us and completed the blessing. The prophet, may God bless him and give him peace, has indeed spoken about everything. So the law, everything that will bring us closer to the garden. So the garden of paradise. Now, Sophia Vassiliou has observed this, as others have observed this thinking within Ibn Taymiyyah. And Sophia Vassiliou wrote this book, Ibn Taymiyyah's Theological Ethics, in 2016, which I'm drawing from very briefly. It's an extensive book. It's really a sophisticated piece of work. But one thing.
I just love the way, by the way, she interacts with Western scholars. I mean, she and thinkers and philosophers, like she mentions Voltaire, she mentions David Hume, and others. She is a very rich interreligious, interphilosophical discourse in her book, which makes it very, for me, very fascinating, because I'm very interested, obviously, in both the Islamic tradition and the Western tradition to the extent that they overlap or interconnect that way.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. That's Sophia Vassiliou's, one of her really strong points. She's conversant in both traditions and can tie them together.
Exactly.
Yeah, so one thing she notes is that for Ibn Taymiyyah, revelation specifies all human benefits, just what I've been saying. She concludes from that, though, that Ibn Taymiyyah is just rationalizing the revealed law. He's saying, yeah, benefit, that's rational. And that's what the revealed law gives us. And so she concludes in a certain fashion that therefore there's not much left for us to do in terms of thinking. So Ibn Taymiyyah is just rationalizing the revealed law, making it look really great, really beneficial. And that leaves very little room for independent ethical reasoning. And she's right, but I would argue only to a point. Because he is indeed rationalizing the revealed law as fully congruent with our full benefit. There's no benefit that's, there's no real benefit outside the law. Ibn Taymiyyah does, I don't have this on a further slide, but I should clarify, he does see benefit for people doing things that are outside the law, like practicing, according to him, celebrating the prophet's birthdays outside the law. And he sees even that some people can benefit from practicing it, but he then says, and they can even get a certain reward from practicing it or celebrating it, but the detriments are always greater than the benefits. So therefore it doesn't congrue with the law and you shouldn't do it, because if you would rather pray the ritual prayers and other supererogatory works, that'll be beneficial as opposed to celebrating the prophet's birthday, which on the whole is detrimental. But he doesn't deny there might be some benefit in there for some people to a certain degree. So back to
the Quran itself speaks in those terms about drinking wine or intoxicants rather, which are prohibited. But nevertheless, it says there is some benefit in them, but the harm is far greater. I think the same with gambling as well. It mentions those two specifically. So it's a very kind of nuanced position here. It's not kind of very binary. There is a sense of balancing out the consequences and the costs and the benefits.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that leads very nicely to the next slide. This is what I think Vassiliou doesn't quite fully grasp. The utilitarian principle at work in Ibn Taymiyyah's thinking, and in particular, it's what do you do when following the law perfectly and attaining full benefit is not possible? This can be for any number of reasons. It could be because of human weakness, or it could be human ignorance. We just don't know because we haven't studied the law adequately. He's very reticent. He thinks the law does speak to everything important. I should qualify here. There are particular things that we always have to reason out. For example, which direction do you pray? Okay. The law says you should pray toward Mecca, but when you're in different parts of the world, you have to figure that on your own. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about when you are simply ignorant of the law because you haven't studied well enough, or you don't know somebody who knows it well enough, or because there's too much human weakness or corruption in the land and you simply can't follow the law perfectly and attain full benefit. It's simply not possible. So how do you figure out what you're supposed to do? So I have this long quote here, which I'm going to read in full, where he answers this question. He says, one has to investigate. If the right is greater, it is commanded, even if it necessarily entails something wrong of lesser import. Wrong is not prohibited if prohibiting it necessarily entails losing something right greater than it. Indeed, prohibiting in that case would be tantamount to blocking the way of God. If the wrong is predominant, then it is prohibited, even if this involves losing something less right, or right, losing something right that is less than it. Commanding that lesser right that involves a greater wrong is commanding wrong and furthering disobedience to God and his messenger. If right and wrong are intertwined and equally in balance, then they are neither commanded nor prohibited. Sometimes it is beneficial to command, and sometimes it is beneficial to prohibit. It all depends on the specific and actual circumstances. So, yeah.
Can I give an example from your excellent chapter in your book on page 32, actually, where you reference an example that Ibn Taymiyyah gives where omitting a prohibition of a wrong averts another wrong that would be even more detrimental. He gives an example. He notes that a king who converts to Islam should not be prohibited from drinking wine if prohibition would lead him to apostatize. And that's fascinating, typical of the of his cost benefit analysis here, that, you know, instead of simply having a very kind of simplistic rule bound application of law, well, the king is drinking, he must be, knowing the king will apostate, but the greater harm there would be losing the king completely and perhaps even having a non-Muslim ruler. And I thought that subtlety of thought there, that hikmah, the wisdom, actually was very striking. And you give a number of examples in your chapter about that, actually.
Yeah, thank you for mentioning that. I'm actually going to mention that example in a little bit. And you're absolutely right. He's trying to encourage us to think subtly and carefully about what we're doing rather than just say, oh, God commanded us to do this, therefore we do it.
Exactly.
And perhaps in the process create all sorts of trouble that far exceeds the
and this is not a bidder, this is not an innovation, of course, because he ties it or roots it very much in the practice, the sunnah of the Prophet Muhammad, upon whom be peace. And you mentioned some of those examples. This is actually very orthodox Islam, really, but it's expressed in a very kind of philosophical, theoretical way to bring out the issues, the underlying principles at stake.
Yeah. And that underlying principle is the utilitarian principle.
Yeah.
So there's a treatise that Ibn Taymiyyah wrote that a couple of scholars have drawn upon, but nobody sort of surveyed the whole thing. And that's what I do in my book chapter. So I call this section Treatise on the Caliphate, of course, Utilitarian Principle and Practice, Ibn Taymiyyah's Treatise on the Caliphate. Now, the problem he's addressing here is that we have in Sunni Islam the Rashidun, the rightly guided caliphs, and the Khulafa al-Rashidun. And we can call this, Ibn Taymiyyah calls this first four caliphs period. So that's the caliphate of Abu Bakr, then Omar, then Uthman, then Ali, the caliphate of prophecy. So this afterwards fell into kingship. And Ibn Taymiyyah says, of course, people after that were called caliphs, but in Islamic political thinking, there's this idea that there was a kind of falling away from the ideal after that initial period.
Yeah.
And different political theorists in the Islamic tradition have wrestled with this in different ways. So this is what Ibn Taymiyyah does here in this case. You know, so how serious is this problem, really? For Ibn Taymiyyah, it's not too serious. He says a king who does a lot of good with a bit of evil mixed in is better than someone who does a little good and avoids evil entirely. So he has in mind here the person who is so bound up by concern for doing the right thing that they can't see the big picture of what needs doing in order to achieve the longer term goal or the wider societal goals of producing a society in which worship can take place. And in fact, encouraging people to worship God. And that's the role of the ruler in his thinking, is that they are supposed to encourage and facilitate the worship of God, ibadah.
Yeah.
So he says in his view, then, the caliphate of prophecy is an obligation, but its lack is not a major sin. So the fact there's not prophecy or caliphate of prophecy in that technical sense of the early ideal period, that's just a minor sin. And sometimes we have to indulge human weakness in sin in order to get on with it, as it were, in his view. Now, I need to clarify here, you'll find in many books on Islamic political theory that Ibn Taymiyyah says the caliphate is not required at all. It's not an obligation on the Muslim community. There's other scholarship that I'm drawing on, a very recent scholarship, so that's not correct. That he does hold the caliphate to be an obligation, but it's not the reality of the day, and it's simply too difficult to put into practice, and he's making an allowance. It's a minor sin, and we can achieve still a lot of good in terms of advancing religion and helping people worship without having the perfect caliphate in place.
Can I just pause on that very important point that you just made, particularly in Western scholarship, without going into the etiology of it, there has been this profound error and misunderstanding and mistranslating Ibn Taymiyyah's point on the caliphate. And this is being corrected now in more recent scholarship, not least by yourself and some other scholars who Ibn Taymiyyah did see the caliphate as obligatory, but its absence was a sin. In the way you describe, and also he's taking into account of human weakness and human sinfulness as an important understanding and context for implementing Islam. So I'm just grateful you're stressing that point that Taymiyyah did see the caliphate as obligatory, but nevertheless in the caveated sense that you've just described.
Yeah, thank you. So another long quote, where he talks about, I'm having trouble here.
Yep, okay, we got it. Treaty of the Caliphate.
Okay, I'm probably the... All right. Here, yeah, good. So he says an example. What he's talking about here is examples of human weakness requiring us to accept that things aren't perfect and that we still act for the good as much as possible. An example is the public leader who cannot bring himself to achieve the benefits of administrative authority in commanding the right and prohibiting the wrong, carrying out prescribed punishments, securing the roads, undertaking jihad against the enemy, and distributing resources without engaging in some prohibited things, like expropriating some of the resources, domineering the people, showing favoritism and distribution, and other such capricious behaviors. This gets really interesting now. The scholar, so the religious scholar, is not able to bring himself to study the science of jurisprudence and the theological foundations of religion without certain kinds of prohibited things like ungrounded opinion and rationalist theology. And he cannot bring himself to study the science of the legislated rites of worship and the knowledge that is commanded without a certain kind of monkishness. Now,
you make a really interesting point here in your book chapter. I hope you're going to expand on this last sentence about. Yep. I'll let you tell us about that.
Yeah. Okay. So Yahya Micho has a whole article on this in French, in which he speculates that perhaps Ibn Taymiyyah's reason for never marrying, and Ibn Taymiyyah did believe that a man should marry, but Ibn Taymiyyah himself never did it. So this is a part of the law which he didn't keep. So Micho speculates that perhaps Ibn Taymiyyah rationalized his disobedience with the need to dedicate his time and energy fully to his scholarship and his religious reform activity.
Yes.
The thing is, Ibn Taymiyyah never really comes out and says this, but it's a useful speculation.
It's the only one I've ever heard, because I've often wondered why Ibn Taymiyyah married. But obviously, he was completely married in a sense, or devoted to his work. And he's an incredibly productive man, whether he's in prison or not, or whatever he was doing. He was churning out these incredible treaties. But why did he never marry? And I think, you know, it was a weakness, perhaps, as he says in this particular quote. He could not bring himself to study the science and legislative rites of worship and the knowledge that is commanded without a certain degree of, you know, retreat from the world, retreat from the pleasures of marriage, not indulging in that. So it was a weakness on his part. And I agree it's not proof, but it's the best theory I've come across yet.
It's certainly compelling. Yeah. Good. Another example, which you, Paul, have already mentioned, is do not tell a king who converted to Islam not to drink wine if that would lead him to apostatize. And then Ibn Taymiyyah ends this whole treatise making the point that according to the circumstances, the Prophet's position varied regarding his command, his prohibition, his jihad, his pardon, his carrying out of the prescribed punishments, the hudud punishments, his harshness, and his mercy. So the Prophet's position is utilitarian calculation. So my conclusion to this first half of my argument is for Ibn Taymiyyah, utilitarian calculation is the way of the Prophet.
Exactly.
When it's not possible to follow the law perfectly, or there's simply a lack of knowledge about what that might look like in the respective circumstances.
I think it's a really important point. If I may go completely off subject for a second, I noted reading the Christian Gospels in the New Testament, the way Jesus is sometimes portrayed exhibits these kinds of qualities, I think. In other words, he is not legalistic. He sometimes acknowledges human weakness and sinfulness, like the woman caught in adultery, for example, the way he treats there, not denying the law, but nevertheless seeing other contextual factors in operation. So I there's a bit of Jesus in this as well, if I may put it that way. But that's not your point, so just my point.
Yeah. Well, perhaps what they share is a bit of shrewdness and care and concern in exercising their religious vocations. Yeah,
exactly. That's one way of putting it, yeah.
Right. Now we move to the second part of the argument, which is the theological implications of this utilitarian vision. And we can talk about the ethics of God's actions. What is it that God is up to, you might say, in creating the world, in, you know, what it's I hesitate to use the word, what governs God's actions, but if we can use that expression, what governs God's actions, if we think of God governing God's self. In any case, Sophia Vassiliou has this brilliant quote here. She says, Ibn Taymiyyah's account of God's morality echoes nothing, if not the axiom of utilitarianism articulated by Bentham. It is the greatest happiness of the greatest number that is the measure of right and wrong. So what she's picked up on here is that God himself is, if you look at Ibn Taymiyyah's thinking, is acting in a utilitarian fashion. God is concerned about consequences. God's concerned about benefit and avoiding detriment. Mm-hmm. That's a simple way of putting what God's up to. God, by the way, I can add here, God is about having everybody worship God alone and doing what is possible within the limitations of the way the world is created to lead people to that point. So maximum happiness for Ibn Taymiyyah, his view of God, is everybody worshiping God. And that is what God's seeking as well through God's creation and command in the world. Now, so to attain benefit, God acts for wise purposes or causes. That's given. But how does this work? And this is where it becomes really fascinating theologically. So Ibn Taymiyyah has this treatise called Irada, which is about 70-80 pages in Majmu' Fatawa, the big collection of his writings, in volume 8. And I outline this whole article, or this whole treatise actually, in my book chapter. I'm just going to pull out some bits here. But one thing Ibn Taymiyyah is facing is this trilemma. In fact, this is the origin of the treatise. Somebody presents him with this trilemma, this problem. So I quote it here. Concerning the goodness of the will of God, does God create for a cause or for other than a cause? If it is said not for a cause, then God is aimless. Exalted is God above that. And, you know, heaven forbid that God should be aimless. If it is said for a cause, and if you say that it is eternal, that is, if the cause is eternal, it follows necessarily that the effect is eternal. And if you say that the cause is temporally originated, or muhtatha, it follows necessarily that it had a cause, and that cause had a cause, and that cause had a cause, and so on, into an endless chain. But an endless chain or an endless regress is absurd. So that's the puzzle that Ibn Taymiyyah was presented with.
Yeah, it's not Ibn Taymiyyah's puzzle. It's one that he was presented with, and that's, and he interacts with the philosophical assumptions and so on in that. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not to say that he hadn't thought about this before. it's a puzzle I'm sure he was thinking about, and it just was triggered. He was triggered by this presentation.
As a kid, I expect he was thinking about this, knowing him. But anyway,
So who are these people that are in scope here? So who says that God acts not for a cause? Well, this is the Ash'ari tradition, the idea that God doesn't have purposes to God's acts. And so a negative assessment of that is that God is aimless. And I'll say more in a bit about why they think that God doesn't act for a cause. Now, if it's said for a cause and that cause is eternal, then the effect is eternal and the world's eternal.
Yeah.
The argumentation here is that of the philosophers like Ibn Sina, or otherwise known as Avicenna. And then the third position, if you say that the cause is temporally originated, it comes into being in time, then it follows that that had a cause and so on into an endless chain. The Mu'tazilis don't quite say this, but they do say that God acts for a cause, which is temporally originated. They would say it doesn't go back in an endless chain. But nonetheless, and other people too, like the Karamiyya, and Ibn Taymiyyah says lots of people from the Hanbalis and the Shafis and the Hanafis and the Malikis come out on this position. I think he's being a bit generous there, but he clearly is favoring the third position without coming down clearly and saying, this is my view. But so where does he come out and how does he get there? That's the question here. So let's look first at the Ash'ari objections to God acting for a wise purpose or a cause. First, God acting for wise purposes or causes would entail an infinite regress, which is impossible in their view. Each cause would need a prior cause to bring it into existence. Second objection, it would entail temporarily originating events or hawadith in God's essence. This means there would be things going on temporarily. There would be time in God's essence. And there would be change in God's essence. And actually, say that's simply wrong. Third point, God acting for a wise purpose or a cause would imply that God was imperfect beforehand and not self-sufficient prior to acting, but then was perfected by achieving his wise purpose. So God was perfect and because or imperfect, and since God was imperfect and not self-sufficient, God had to do something about it, had to do a little work, as it were, to attain full perfection. And for the Ashadis, this is simply...
Without anticipating Ibn Taymiyyah's response, but I'll just say that I always find Ibn Taymiyyah's responses to these seemingly straight-jacketed philosophical conundrums to be very creative and thinking outside of the box, so to speak, and quite simply brilliant and almost breathtaking when one first comes across them. And that's one of the reasons I have a great deal of respect for him as a thinker. His subtlety and sophistication of his mind is truly incredible. I think he stands as alongside other great geniuses in the West and in Islamic tradition. One could list names, but he is truly of the first order. I mean, that's my personal praise of him.
He cuts to the quick really well, and. Mm. He does think he has to think outside the box if he's going to break through these challenges. Yeah. And what's even, you know, in terms of it took me a long time to break through these nuts as well, because, you know, a lot of theological thinking is of a certain kind, like the Ashadis, and to actually see what he's doing and grasp that is not easy either. But yeah, it takes perseverance. So the Ashadis conclude from all this that God does not act for wise purposes or causes. God doesn't, God, to put it simply, doesn't do things for reasons. God's will is eternal. So that means God is purpose, is not acting for purpose. God is what's called, he's acting according to voluntaristic. He's just a voluntarist. He does whatever God does what God's will. There's no reason. You can't ask why.
Will, pure will. He just does things because he wills. Yeah, it's extraordinary. If you kind of schooled in the Quran and the way the prophetic tradition speaks of God, you think, what a strange view to have, actually. But that's why I gave my own personal response. And you can perhaps understand better Ibn Taymiyyah's response. But hey, that's my own judgment.
Yeah, in defense of the Ashadis, I mean, their own defense is that it gives God the highest glory and power to think of God's will as being without cause. It gives God all the power and the glory. That's their defense, you might say. Mm. But also in terms of temporality, the Ashadis say God's will is eternal. It's outside time. And additionally, the world had a beginning. So you know, that's to rule out this whole business of a infinite regress. Okay, now what about the Mu'tazilis? So like the Ash'aris, the world had a beginning and God is not subject to temporal events. But against the Ash'aris, they say a God who does not act for wise purposes or causes is vain and foolish, basically irrational. A God who doesn't act for a reason is simply acting for no reason. So they would say, God acts for wise purposes, or God acts for purposes that are disjoined from God's essence. Why disjoined? Well, because if these wise purposes were inside of God, then God would be temporal. So these are wise purposes that benefit humanity, because in the Mu'tazili theology of God's justice, God is trying to do what is best for humanity. Mm. And God has an obligation, in fact, to act to the benefit of humanity. But they put the purposes outside of God's essence because they want to retain God's integrity, if you will, or God's not being subject to anything temporal. And also they don't want God to be impacted by these wise purposes, because God is above being in need of of doing things in order to attain his perfection. So God, for the Mu'tazili, is above all of our human, the vicissitudes of our human experience, but yet God is working for our benefit. But that working for our benefit needs to take place outside of God's essence in order to protect God's essence from any kind of temporality or change. So the Ash'aris are singularly unimpressed with this. They retort, even wise purposes that are disjoined from God will still somehow subject God to temporality. And such a God will still suffer from being perfected by his wise purposes in some fashion. He simply can't escape it. So we move on then to the philosophers, or Ibn Sina in particular. The philosophers look at both the Ash'aris and the Mu'tazilis. Of course, they're both in the category of Kalam theology. And the philosophers say that these two groups cannot avoid temporal origination and change in God's essence if, in fact, God is creating with a will. So you can't pretend that you can get temporality out of an eternal will, or you can't pretend to get temporality or God's, you can't have this disjoint stuff that the Mu'tazilis are talking about. It's simply not going to work, and it's all going to involve changing God, and that would make God imperfect. So the philosopher's way of approaching this matter is that the timelessly eternal God emanates the world as an eternal effect. Therefore, the world's eternal. Now, if you're familiar with Ibn Sina's philosophy, there's a whole bunch of emanations. There are 10 intellects and so forth. All of this is to provide some distance between the simple, timelessly eternal God and the multiplicity of our world, but that whole scheme, that emanation from God, is eternal. It's a singular eternal effect from God.
It seems to be drawing very heavily on Plotinus, the Neoplatonic philosopher, who certainly wasn't a Muslim or a Christian, particularly in his book The Aeneids, which I think speaks. I think without going into the etiology of these beliefs. Because I'm reading Plotinus at the moment, and I'm just struck by the similarity.
Indeed. Ibn Sina is a species of Neoplatonism with a good bit of Aristotle included. Additionally, for the philosophers, God does not act for purposes, because that would also obviously introduce some kind of change in God. God's will is tantamount to God's knowledge, because God cannot be willing the way we do, or the way even the Ash'aris think. And for the philosophers, God is not lacking in perfection. God in his perfection loves himself, and from his self-love flows the best possible world. So God's fundamental relation is with God's self and not with the world. The world is a necessary concomitant, that's the language, or an emanation from God. It's an accidental product, but a necessary accidental product of who God is in God's self. Well, back to the trilemma, just to review where we are. We're talking about the goodness of the will of God, and does God create for a cause? For the Ash'aris, God does not create for a cause. And so the critics of the Ash'aris say that God's aimless. The philosophers say God creates for a cause that is eternal, which leads to an eternal effect, which for the Ash'aris and the Mu'tazilis, and Ibn Taymiyyah for that matter, is wrong. And then the Mu'tazilis talk about a temporally originated cause, but God is indeed acting here for a cause. It's temporally originated. That leads to an endless chain, which is absurd, according to the trilemma. So where does Ibn Taymiyyah go from here? Against the Ash'aris, what we get here is a dynamic God. So it's the title of the slide here, Dynamic God of Ibn Taymiyyah. So against the Ash'aris, he says, a God who does not create for wise purposes is vain and foolish, just like the Mu'tazilis say. He also says an eternal will cannot create temporal events. This is very important to understand for Ibn Taymiyyah. You simply cannot get temporality out of something that is timeless. And the Ash'aris view the will of God as timeless. They say that's what a will means. Al-Ghazali is well known for this, that what it means for God to have a will is to make that transition from eternity to temporality. So it's in the very nature of God's eternal will that God will or enact temporal events. Ibn Taymiyyah does not buy that. Against the philosophers, Ibn Taymiyyah says there's no emanation, there's no eternal effect. Temporality cannot arise from timeless eternity. Same criticism he has against the Asharis. Against the Mu'tazilis, he says, well, if you're going to disjoin wise purposes or causes from God's essence, then they're not gods anymore. He gives an example in a different context of if God creates the hair on my head, is this God's hair or my hair? It's obviously my hair. So if God creates wise purposes that are outside of God, they're the wise purposes of something, somebody else or something else. They're not gods anymore. So it's simply nonsensical. And then against the Mu'tazilis, he also said God is not indifferent to creatures. Whereas the Mu'tazilis are trying to hold God's, preserve God's integrity or whatever from interference from creatures. Ibn Taymiyyah says this is simply not the case. It's irrational for God not to act for his own benefit and praise. Mm-hmm. And this is where Ibn Taymiyyah might surprise some. He is saying if God's not acting for God's own interests, this is actually irrational. So I have a quote which puts that clearly. Before I get to the quote, I sum up here the dynamic God of Ibn Taymiyyah. God in his perfection, so God is perfect according to Ibn Taymiyyah. God in his perfection, number two, acts and creates by his will and power. So God's action is triggered, or the instruments of God's acts are his will and power. In Ashadi theology, because God's will is eternal, it's very difficult to connect God's power to that eternal will. And it looks like the act is in time, so it doesn't really hold together very well. Ibn Taymiyyah says very clear that God acts by means of his will and power. So this is
part of his essence, his will and his power, part of his essence, and not kind of semi-detached attributes that are not part of God's essence.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the Ash'aris wouldn't say that God's attributes are not part of God, of course, but the point of them being eternal is that they're not subject to change. They're not subject to temporal activity. And Ibn Taymiyyah says, well, then you can't get temporal activity out of them. Rather, my view of God is that God acts for and creates by his will and power. The will and power are active. They're active temporally. And so it makes more sense. And then God acts for wise purposes or causes that three things subsist in his essence as temporal events. They regress infinitely into the past and they redound to his own benefit. So Ibn Taymiyyah has no problem with a dynamic view of God in a temporal sense. Mm-hmm. He's not saying God is subject to time. Rather, he's saying that time arises out of God's activity.
Right.
So God is not somehow bound. Time is not something that's outside of God. It's something that arises out of God's perfection.
And indeed, there's a detail of the Prophet Muhammad upon it that God is time. Just throw that in.
I hadn't put those two together. Yeah, I'm aware of the hadith, but
you said that time is a part of God. It's not something external or above him. Therefore, God, in some sense, is time, if that hadith is relevant to this.
I don't know if Ibn Taymiyyah deals with that hadith, but there's a sense in which that would certainly fit here. Yeah, good. Thanks. So about this God benefiting from God's own acts, he has a quotation from this treatise Irada, which I'm following. Anyone who commits an act in which there is neither pleasure nor benefit nor profit for himself in any respect, neither sooner nor later, is aimless, and he is not praised for this. And to Ibn Taymiyyah's mind, this applies to God and humans alike.
Yep.
So God acts for wise purposes that redound to his own benefit. Two other quotations which bring out the ideas just mentioned. In Manhaj as-Sunnah, which is Ibn Taymiyyah's big refutation of 12-er Shi'ism, he writes, God has been active from eternity when he willed with acts that subsist in his self or in his essence by his power and his will one after another. in other words, in temporal sequence. Another quotation from Manhaj Sunda: acting is an attribute of perfection. God, exalted as he has said, is then he who creates as one who does not create? Will you not then remember? That being the case, in other words, is then he who creates as one who does not create? Obviously, somebody who creates is better than one who does not create. That being the case, it is reasonable that the agent who acts by his will and his power is more perfect than one having no power and no will. So activity is the height of perfection for Ibn Taymiyyah, not eternal perfection that is still, that is unmoving, that is fixed.
I was going to say static and quite Greek, actually. I'm trying to bite my tongue here. I'm not going on, Greek philosophy. But I'm just reminded of Plato's, I'm just reading Plato's Republic as well. He talks about his theory of forms and the good. This is a very static conception as opposed to the temporal changing realm. And I keep on hearing the influence of Greek philosophy in some of this, not in Ibn Taymiyyah, of course.
Yeah, well, I mean, the idea behind that is that what is perfect is so perfect that if you move away from it in any direction, it's going to become imperfect. So it has to be static and timeless. Whereas Ibn Taymiyyah is simply turning all that on its head. Yeah. And in that sense, he's very modern. He is profoundly anti-Platonic.
But you make an interesting point in your chapter in your book. You say he's not to be confused with modern process theologians like A.M. Whitehead, the British Christian philosopher, who, without going into process theology, is a completely different subject, but actually it is very different and not to be confused with that. I thought that was a very helpful juxtaposition there.
Yeah, thank you for raising that. Ibn Taymiyyah is, so Whitehead and process theology, process philosophy, opens up the possibility that God could go out of existence if we, in fact, as human beings in the universe. So God's body is the universe, whereas Ibn Taymiyyah does not hold to that at all. And for Ibn Taymiyyah, God is indestructible, whereas for process theology, God is not entirely indestructible. So process theology, to put it very concretely, would say if we don't take care of our universe, we don't take care of our planet, we don't take care of our environment, we could just mess everything up and we could, you know, put ourselves out of existence. Ibn Taymiyyah would have none of that, because for him, God is indestructible and the universe is not God's body. So there's big differences there. But Ibn Taymiyyah's view of God is dynamic, like process theology.
Exactly.
There's activity and there's a possibility of a different story coming in the future, as there were different stories in the past. But how does he think about that? So let's keep going. How does he respond to the Ash'ari objections? So one of the Ash'ari objections was God acting for wise purposes or causes would entail infinite regress. Each cause would need a prior cause to bring it into existence. So Ibn Taymiyyah, in fact, refutes these arguments. And I haven't even given the arguments against infinite regress that the Ash'aris bring forth. And he refutes what they do say in his Manhaj as-Sunnah and to some degree in Dar al-Ta'arud, which is his largest, his masterwork on the congruity of revelation and reason. Yeah. Now, these arguments are opaque, they're difficult, and they require a separate session if we were to go into them. I'm not sure it's that valuable to go into them, certainly not here. But point is, he allows an infinite regress. He has no problem with that. Second Ash'ari objection, it would entail temporality, or rather it would entail temporally originating events, hawadith in God's essence, if we had God acting for purposes. And there would be change in God, heaven forbid, there'd be change in God. Ibn Taymiyyah affirms temporally originating events in God's essence. He doesn't have problems. He doesn't think this endangers God's simplicity. Rather, I should say, he thinks of God's simplicity differently. He doesn't think of it as having no differentiation within God. Now, Ibn Taymiyyah doesn't particularly like this word, temporally originating events. It's a word from Kalam. He acknowledges that his position is what that's what that is. It's what he's talking about. But he prefers to refer to these originating events rather as God's voluntary attributes and acts. So they're things based on God's will, God acting by God's power and will. God does not change according to Timea. Now, this is a bit of a terminological shift. Of course, God is temporally active, but what Ibn Taymiyyah means here is that God is consistent in his attributes and character. So we can talk about God's faithfulness. We can talk about God's love. We can talk about God's mercy. God is consistent in exercising these things. That doesn't mean that God has somehow got this singular character or singular attribute of mercy, which never changes.
Yeah.
And is eternally timeless, eternal.
Definitely a more dynamic conception of God. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, perhaps the most difficult critique of the Ash'aris, God acting for a wise purpose or cause would imply that God was imperfect and not self-sufficient prior to acting, and then God perfected himself by achieving his wise purpose. God was making up for some lack within himself by acting for a wise purpose. So Ibn Taymiyyah says, fine, yeah, that's great. It is rational to be perfected by one's acts, not a problem.
I love the way he just simply turns the whole thing on its head and says, no problem. Beat that. I mean, with one masterstroke, he simply disappears the problem. Fantastic.
Yeah, indeed. It's quite striking. Continuing along the same lines, he says, a God who cannot act for wise purpose is imperfect and not praiseworthy. In other words, if you have somebody who's acting like the Ash'aris, according to an eternal will with no reasons, they simply not what they're doing is not praiseworthy. It's not perfect. You can't call that type of activity perfect. Certainly you wouldn't do that in human affairs, no. He would argue. And he argues further that what God creates is the best possible. In other words, God is creating the best of all possible worlds.
And also, this is completely off topic and it's a diversion, but I can't help but think of Voltaire's Candide and Pangloss, whenever one talks about God creating the best of possible worlds, which was, I don't want to mention it because it's almost wrong, but the way obviously Voltaire disagreed with that notion, shall we say, satirically in his famous Enlightenment book, Candide. But that's a complete diversion. But it just struck me as that phrase is very evocative of that work in a modern context, I would say.
Yeah, thank you for that. And it's important to note here that this expression has, it goes back to Ibn Sina. Ibn Sina, I mentioned earlier in this presentation that he also believed God had emanated the best of all possible world, the best possible world. Mm. And there's debate. Al-Ghazali is famous for having said that God, there's nothing in possibility greater than what is, implying that God has created the best of all possible worlds. Ibn Taymiyyah then picks up on that, probably in what are his later writings, and affirms likewise, as long as as long as it's clear God could have done something else because God's powerful, all powerful, but God has in fact chosen in his wise purpose to create the best possible. It's a really striking result. And the reason I bring it in here is to underline that for Ibn Taymiyyah, God is acting wisely for purposes. There's intentionality here. And it's not just that God is acting intentionally and with wise purposes, and sometimes he makes a mistake, or sometimes he does things which he, aren't completely rational because, it could have gone either way. No, God has created the best possible at every point in time. It couldn't have been any better. Now, we might, and you mentioned Voltaire, we might beg to disagree, but that's part of the spiritual struggle of seeing the full reality. And we tend not to do that very well because we're stuck in our limited perspectives.
Yeah.
Ibn Taymiyyah going on here about God's self-sufficiency. If God is acting on our behalf or is interacting with our circumstances, and it seems God would be somehow impacted by what we're doing, and perhaps that suggests that God is not self-sufficient. Now, Ibn Taymiyyah says God is not indifferent, so God is interacting with us, but God ultimately does not need another. God does not need us to be self-sufficient. So we're not actually supplying something that God lacks. Rather, God is perfected through his own acts, just as he is perfected through his attributes and his essence. So God's perfection for Ibn-Taymiyyah includes not just attributes, but also acts. So if God were not acting, God would be less than perfect. So God is perpetually active out of God's perfection. Now, Ibn Taymiyyah does draw on Ibn Sina, as well as Ibn Rushd, a later philosopher, occasionally to solve problems. Here he draws on Ibn Sina. He invokes Ibn Sina's notion of God's self-love. So the way he does it, he invokes God's self-love as the source of God's love for believers and their worship and obedience. There's this choice quote here, again from this treatise Irada. What God loves of worship of him and obedience to him follows from love for himself. And love of that is the cause of his love for his believing servants. His love for believers follows from love for himself. So God doesn't love the worship of him and obedience to him because he's needy. He doesn't need us to worship him because he's lacking. No, he loves that because it's something that follows on from his love for himself. So God's self-love is the source of our worship, in fact. It's the source of his love for our belief and our obedience and our love. So what Ibn Taymiyyah is trying to do here is make it so we don't think about God needing us. So ultimately, for God, God ultimately has no need of human worship and is fully perfect, fully perfect and self-sufficient. Good. So I'm going to take two quotations to conclude this presentation. One from my book in 2019, accentuating what I've just been discussing. For Ibn Taymiyyah, God acts on account of wise purposes subsisting in God's essence that redound to both creatures and God himself. Ibn Taymiyyah's God is self-interested and utilitarian in much the same fashion as human beings. So God has an agenda, you might say. God is acting to get something to happen, which it's quite clear to my mind that the whole God's agenda, if you will, is that in the end, we all worship God, that all of creation, all human beings are worshiping God alone. And then from this article, Foundations of Ibn Taymiyyah's Religious Utilitarianism, I conclude here, as a theologian, ethicist, and jurist, Ibn Taymiyyah provides an Avicennan-informed apology. That Avicenna refers, of course, to Ibn Sina. Ibn Taymiyyah provides an Avicennan-informed apology for the utilitarian rationality of God's creation and God's command. What God creates is the best possible. And what God commands through the revealed law encompasses all benefit. This law not only specifies obligations and prohibitions, it also provides the prophet's exemplary utilitarianism as the operative principle when perfect obedience to obligations and prohibitions is too difficult or impossible. So you have two principles here. The law gives obligations and prohibitions first, and then second, there's utilitarian reasoning when we have situations which are too difficult or impossible. And this is the way of the prophet, according to Ibn Taymiyyah.
Yeah.
So thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. Fantastic, actually. Let me just take that down. Thank you very much indeed, John, for that fascinating storyline, taking us through Ibn Taymiyyah's thought on this subject. And I just want to reiterate, as you have done, some of the books you mentioned. This is your own book, of course, Makers of the Muslim World. I've read it. It's an excellent introduction to the whole gamut of his thought. It's actually a very good biographical chapter as well, if you want to know his life and teachings in situ in history. So very readable, good, solid introduction, I think, to Ibn Taymiyyah. There's another work you've referenced many times. I love this cover, Ibn Taymiyyah's Theological Ethics by Sophia Vassiliou, published by Oxford University Press. This is a very rich meal. I found this, as mentioned, you know, she's often interacting with the Western academic or philosophical tradition as well. Do recommend that. Also, another one of my favorites, you haven't mentioned, but you referenced the work, is this book actually is a study of reason and revelation. And this is by a friend of mine, Professor Carl Sherev Al-Tubgi from Brandeis University in America, Ibn Taymiyyah on reason and revelation. This is actually his doctoral dissertation. But it is really fascinating read. If you're interested in epistemology, particularly a relationship between reason and faith, if you like, put very simplistically. Another work you did reference, I think, Muslims Under Non-Muslim Rule by Ibn Taymiyyah by Yahya Michaud, who I think is a Belgian French-speaking scholar. Excellent book, again, very readable and very relevant if people had concerns about Islamic extremism and so on, and how non-Muslims are treated under Islamic rule, very salutary. And another related theme, I think, is this book by Yahya Michaud again, forward by the American scholar Bruce Lawrence, Ibn Taymiyyah Against Extremisms, which again is counterintuitive if you have kind of a Western notion of an uninformed Western notion of what Ibn Taymiyyah was actually about as well. So if I had to pick one of those to read and benefit from, it would have to be this, of course, your own work, Ibn Taymiyyah, recently written. So do get that if you want to explore this titan of the Islamic tradition. I don't mean John, I mean Ibn Taymiyyah, to appreciate his enduring influence, again, in the modern world. Many people, he's experienced some kind of a renaissance. People are interested in Ibn Taymiyyah's thinking for all sorts of reasons, but he's certainly worth reading. So thank you so much, Professor John Hoover, for your excellent presentation.
Well, thank you. It's been a great pleasure, and thank you for plugging my book. It's a real pleasure to be talking to you.
Good. No, it's worthwhile reading. So thank you very much. Until next time. Assalamu alaikum.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.